back with episode 731 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, well, at least some of us are still holding down the fort before we, head off to the four points of the compass.
That's right, and, as Edmund was just saying, we are trying to get in a few shows before we, are all on the VOG network running off to Dragon Con, but, yeah, we've got a little bit of news from the last time that we recorded. We've got some episodic discussion, and maybe we'll have enough for two episodes this week so that we can also get into our top 10. But before we do any of that, Edmund, I think that you have to give a disclaimer.
Yes, as ever, we will talk about whatever we feel like talking about. So if you haven't heard about this stuff, we will spoil you silly about it.
That's right. And, well, we're going to go ahead and start with the news. And that is going to be a short list this week as we start with some news coming out of the CW. Really, nothing that would be called headline news, so to speak. But, well, apparently The Lost Boys, that movie from 1987, is getting a little bit of new life as, well, the CW is looking to resurrect it. The bad news is, bad news is if you are looking for something really intense, it's probably not going to happen since this is the CW and it's probably being seen as the successor to The Vampire Diaries. But basically, let's see here. The first season of The Lost Boys is said to be in set in San Francisco in 1967. The band The Doors, whose poster decorates the strange scenes inside the original film's vampire cave, just put out their People Are Strange single. Every season subsequently will be set in a different decade. The final seventh season would feature the characters in a contemporary 2020s setting. Huh.
They're being awfully optimistic, yes.
Aren't they, though? Rob Thomas, who created Veronica Mars and iZombie, will be the showrunner, writer, and executive producer.
Hmm.
Yeah, so boy, are they being awfully ambitious. That's to say the least.
Yeah, indeed. Although the one thing I find funny about this article, you know, and it's a sort of a cliche that that I think I tended to lapse into, especially sort of at the beginning of my jumping on the supernatural bandwagon and seeing what else is going on in the CW. But I think there's a little bit of a holdover in this article about that original sense of the CW as being full of teen angst and relationships. So that was certainly something we saw in the early years of the DCW. But at this point, I think given the way the CW has been rebranding itself and sort of embracing its status as the genre network, this might actually work out better than we might have anticipated in the past.
It may. I know that they were taking a little bit of a shot at the CW, but frankly, they've actually had some pretty good intense material. So I for one would be pretty happy with seeing them do something a little bit different. And like you said, iZombie being a good case of what Rob Thomas can do.
Exactly. Yeah.
On the network. All right. Next on the list, we have news out of, well, no, we've got casting news.
Yes. Sorry. I was a little slow off the marks. I'm not used to doing that so early.
I know. That's throwing me off as well. So we have some news regarding Flash. And essentially, Joey King, best known for roles in Fargo and Independence Day Resurgence, will guest star on The Flash in October as Magenta, a teen with a troubled past. Frances Frankie Kane is a metahuman with the ability to control metal, but her powers come with a dangerous side effect, causing her villainous alter ego known as Magenta to emerge.
Ah.
She's going to appear in the season's third episode. Created by Marv Wolfman and George Perez, Magenta first appeared in a 1982 issue of The New Teen Titans. Given her name and power set, she inevitably draws comparisons to the famed X-Men villain Magneto.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, at one point, Magenta was one of a number of, or I guess it's Magneta?
Magenta, yes, I believe.
Magenta, from the looks of it, but anyway, was one of a number of characters who formed a new team of rogues, which could be notable given that The Flash's third season introduces both Mirror Master and Dr. Alchemy, both members of the rogues at various points in their careers. It looks like... the question is, if this going to be a larger story, considering that Joey King is kind of making a name for herself, or is this going to be a one-off character? It's hard to know, since the whole Flashpoint thing at the end of the previous season is going to be shortish, longish, rumors still unclear on that. So how long anyone who is introduced early in the season might last later into the season is anybody's guess.
Yeah, exactly. Since it does seem the whole, you know, the rumors are that the Flashpoint is going to be resolved by the time we get to the infamous four show crossover. So we shall have to see. But certainly, throwing that little wrinkle in there does offer them the opportunity to have some people come in just for one offs, and then that timeline doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's going to throw a few spanners in the works, as they say. So we'll have to see which characters actually survive the what's the word for it? The reconstitution of the timeline, the reset of the reset, the reconnection. I don't know, one of those. But yeah, maybe this character has only got a short lifespan. Let's put it that way. Sorry, still trying to see if we can get Gary in here before too much longer.
We are trying to stretch out our meager knowledge of the DC universe until our expert actually can weigh in on who this person is. Or maybe
it's not working, unfortunately.
Oh, well.
Because he's not showing up quite yet. All right, Edwin, why don't you move on to our next one here?
Certainly. This is news about Colony, which, season two is coming up. We have news of a couple of new characters. Tony Plana, seen most recently probably in Ugly Betty, will be coming in to play Proxy Alcala, the new proxy of the Los Angeles Block. He is a cunning politician and oozes charisma, and unlike Peter Jacobson Snyder from the first season, he actually fits the public figure job perfectly, playing the role of enlightened leader helping the population through this difficult time. Behind closed doors, Alcala is ruthless and willing to do anything to hold on to his power. So about what we'd expect from the proxy and Colony so far. Meanwhile, Jessica Parker Kennedy, of course, who's been tearing it up in Black Sails, will play Maya, a bold woman who is stationed at a secretive labor camp and willing to take big risks for what she believes in. Basically, danger and seduction are part of her game. So a role that sounds rather similar to what she's been doing on Black Sails for the past few seasons. These will both be recurring roles, in Colony when it comes back for season two, with the date that I think was wrong in this article.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. Not sure when Colony is coming back, yes. So it's hard to say. One would guess sometime in the winter, mm-hmm. but unknown. All right, then. It looks like we might actually have Gary back with us.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Sorry, I'm running a little bit late this morning. Unexpected visitors. Anyway.
Yeah, I almost ran
the other bed. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, we're a well-oiled machine today.
Yes, we are. Anyway, the next news item up is, we're still in, casting news. It's been announced that Vin Diesel will be joining Guardians of the Galaxy to appear in the next Avengers movie, Infinity War. The Avengers face a threat so sinister that in their next film, they'll need help from a completely different team of superheroes, the Guardians of the Galaxy. According to actor Vin Diesel, who voices Groot, the Guardians will be included in Avengers Infinity War. He revealed this during a Facebook live stream event, and he says that he was really thrilled that they'll get to team up with the Avengers. So I guess they're going to be throwing a whole bunch of people into this Infinity War. We'll have to wait and see what other people go in, but I guess they're pulling out all the stops.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it. They're going to have a lot of people trying to come and go throughout this film. So, yeah, it's probably not too surprising, though, that if Thanos is becoming more and more of a threat, that the Guardians of the Galaxy would show up, since he was at least involved somewhat, well, as the villain, so to speak, in the first film.
Indeed.
So, yes, it would seem to fit. All right, Gary, there was an earlier one about DC and the Flash, and there was a character I couldn't tell. It looks like it's Magenta, but is it Magenta, Magneta? I guess.
One second, let me look.
Magenta, I believe. But we were hoping that our resident DC expert could tell us a little bit more.
One second, let me see. Yes, she was, well, in this case, she's being introduced as a Flash villain, but more specifically, she was originally a new Teen Titans villain that George Perez and Marv Wolfman had helped create. And yes, you're to say that she is an homage to Magneto, or perhaps the X-Men character Polaris might be very well a good analogy. And it was mentioned at the time that it seemed, what's the word I'm looking for? A fairly veiled homage to both of those magnetically based characters from X-Men. And it's just what you're much on what you think, that it was, she has these powers, and heck, she even has that slightly, maybe not quite purple, but definitely a hint of, Magneto's color scheme in her original outfit in the comics. And much as they borrow from character to character, yeah, it pretty much, I don't want to use the term ripoff, I'll settle for homage, but yeah, they wanted to use a magnetic character, and that's what they went with. As a side note, DC, another DC magnetic character, Cosmic Boy from the Legion of Superheroes, was often found wearing pink. So perhaps this is a magnetic hue that with which there's some universal constant.
Maybe there is. Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Let's see what is coming in terms of casting for American Gods. A little bit new information.
Yes. Well, the American Gods cast continues to expand. The latest addition is that Corbin Burnson, who it amuses me that this article chooses to characterize as a star of Psych. For those who for those who are too young to remember L.A. Law, has been cast as Vulcan, who is of course an old god. In fact, he goes all the way back to those Greco-Roman days, of course. Vulcan is one of Mr. Wednesday's, Ian McShane's, oldest allies. He has created a comfortable world for himself by harnessing his powers for the modern world, which makes him resistant to Wednesday's plans. Yes, given the clash of old gods and new gods that's going on in, throughout this book and series, one of the old gods who might have thrown in his lot with the newer techies, shall we say. Especially having now read the books, the more I hear about the casting on this show, the happier and more expectant I'm getting for this series.
Yeah, it seems like they have been doing some perfect casting here,
yeah,
to say the least. All right, and finally, one last piece of news.
Yes, this is news from the Hulu's adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale. Joseph Fiennes, of course, perhaps most famous for playing, Shakespeare and Shakespeare in Love, has been cast as Commander Fred Waterford, a founding father of Gilead, powerful, high-ranking official, and, of course, the man who rules the household where Offred, played by Elizabeth Moss, is a handmaid. Latest news on the series is that it will be going into production later this year and premiering on Hulu in 2017.
There you go. So one of those shows that Hulu is going to try to use in order to get
get people to subscribe now that they're not showing all those things they used to subscribe for. Yes.
Yes, that's right. That's what I was about. I was trying to find a nice way to put it.
But sometimes the direct approach is best.
Sometimes. Let's see here. So that is it for the news, because, of course, we covered about 2 weeks worth of news last time, and now we are in a dearth since then.
Well, I'm just happy there's no in memoriam section this time. So.
That's right. We are Senate.
Yes. Yeah. There sort of could have been, but. I was sad to see the passing of Stephen Hill, even though he's not quite in our wheelhouse. But for those who saw the first season of Mission Impossible, and then of course the first 10 seasons of Law and Order, it was sad to see him go this week.
Fair enough. Oh well, scratch my original.
It was nice. It was not a planned in memoriam, but there we go.
Yes.
All right, so what we're going to do is shift gears a little bit, and I'm just going to check one last time here. I guess, Gary, did you have any scores that you wanted to put in? Well, we have a moment.
Yes.
Okay. Go right ahead. And yeah, in the meantime, we will actually go ahead and take a short break. And when we come back, we will get into that episodic discussion. So stay tuned.
Shut up!
All right, and we are back from our break, and we are going to jump in with our episodic discussion. And let's see, what did Gary manage to get? Oh, yes, it may have actually changed. No, it didn't change much of anything. Okay, well, there was a hope. But what that means is that we can go ahead and jump in with, once again, there's six episodes, so we are going to only have a top and bottom show. And we are going to start with our bottom show for the week, and that is Fear the Walking Dead, Season 2, Episode 8, Grotesque. Nick's steadfast search for answers leads him into a deadly dog-eat-dog landscape, and a dark piece of his past is uncovered. Mm. And this one came in at an average of 7.33. I seem to like it just a little bit more than the two of you did. But Gary, why don't you say, why did you feel like this was a dead average episode? No pun intended.
I think I'm just having a hard time getting back into the series. While it had picked up prior to this for me a little bit, I feel like it took like about a half a step back, and I guess I need to have continued viewing to sort of upgrade it. It didn't move me. It didn't do much for me, and it didn't feel like it advanced the story as much as I hoped it would.
How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, I mean, very similar. I mean, especially for the return episode. I mean, to do this this show that was so completely focused on Nick and his new solo journey just seemed like a very strange choice. This really felt like an episode that should have been second or third episode in it felt very strange just getting his story and not getting any feedback on what's happening to anybody else. Nick has gone from being one of the more perplexing characters at the beginning of the show to one of the more intriguing ones now. I just found that decision to focus just on him, I just found very, very strange.
That is strange. I mean, it was one of the things that threw me off initially, and I will be honest, I kept wavering in terms of my score. I was anywhere from down to a 7 up to where I stopped at 8, but really, I guess it comes down to whether or not you can get into what's going on with Nick. And for me, I was doing okay. Because I guess one of the things that had been compelling earlier in the season was the fact that Nick was kind of the one character that was most, I guess, comfortable. Is that the word?
He seemed the most adaptable, I think,
which is kind of what Strand had been saying that was unique about Nick, is that he would have that ability. So it seemed like they were playing with that and showing maybe why he was so able to kind of shift his focus and mind into that space.
Mm-hmm.
But, I guess it's just whether or not you found Nick compelling as a character. Which I can definitely understand why you would, if you didn't really like the character or get into the character previously, it being so focused just on him, it would be a hard sell. I could even see a lot of people outright disliking this episode.
Yeah, it wasn't the thing that I don't find Nick an intriguing character. I mean, that was part of the point I was making. But for the first episode back from the break, I kind of wanted to at least have them do a little bit of their travelogue style that they do sometimes slip into on both of the Walking Dead shows. Where it kind of felt like I at least wanted to know what was going on with the other characters. And what was going on with Nick. Even then, within the structure of the episode, some of the stuff, like when he first came across the bandits, or where he started running away from them, and then just seemed to kind of magically get away, where it's like, oh yes, I just run through this brush, and then all of a sudden they're not chasing me anymore. Even in terms of the way the episode itself was set up, didn't quite hold together for me.
Yeah, I will say that I liked the fact that he was in such dire straits, but he is kind of finding his place in the world. I think that the show still, to a certain degree, is trying too hard. This felt like an episode. Like I said, I wavered back and forth, so I can kind of throw out some criticisms, even though I did give it a slightly higher score. This felt like an episode that either one could consider to be arty or could consider to be trying to be arty. It kind of strayed very close to that line, mm-hmm. Of going over into pretentious. And like I said, there are a lot of different things that one could interpret and, you know, find wanting. But yeah, I was expecting a more conventional return myself.
Yeah, it's definitely something bigger for this. As Edmund was saying, it was a little bit of a letdown for the season return, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. It seemed like they kind of swung for something unusual and it just didn't come together for everybody. But yeah, especially with so much happening in the previous episode to disperse so many characters, to only focus on Nick was a really unusual decision, I think. And a little bit of a gamble, I guess you could say. So, for you guys, it didn't work out. For me, I felt there were parts that did. That said, it may be a little bit telling that I am right now straining to remember what those parts were. Although I do remember the quote unquote herd scene,
yes,
where he was kind of walking in the midst of the zombies, inexorably making his way to lead them to the bandits, who seemed to just stand there and wait for the zombies to come and eat them. But okay,
that I found very strange too, especially given how much of this universe we've come to know over these two series.
It was still a memorable scene. I guess what kind of surprised me is that Nick is sitting there staring the one guy down, mm-hmm. and the guy has a gun.
Yeah.
And he's obviously staring him down, and the guy is freaking out, but he's got a gun. Stand, aim, shoot. Mm-hmm. Seems pretty straightforward, but...
Yeah. Well, especially when he has already been demonstrating that he seems rather good at that. All the people around Nick, but anyway.
Yes. This one came in at the bottom of the list, unfortunately, but there's a lot of room for this show to still maneuver, and I think that the first half of the season did show a lot of promise. I think it's just coming back in this way didn't give the audience necessarily enough to work with in terms of remembering exactly where everybody was left. So, and I'm kind of remembering that The Walking Dead did a season like this, or a half season like this, where coming out of the prison,
mm-hmm.
all of the characters were dispersed.
Yes.
And this feels perhaps a bit familiar as well in that regard. But we shall see if that is how the writers pan this one out. I'm hoping it's not that derivative, but we will find out. That means that we can turn our attention to the top show for the week, and this is probably no surprise to anyone. Mr. Robot, Season 2, Episode 7, Handshake. Mr. Robot and Elliot try to make nice, and Joanna is given an ultimatum. I know which one of those plot threads was more important to me. Yes, this one coming in at an average of 9, both Edmund and I giving it that.
Yep.
And, well, the episode was already awesome based on what Angela was doing throughout the episode, and then Elliot delivered that coup de grace at the end,
mm-hmm.
that left me with my jaw on the, well, at the time, airplane floor.
Yes. Yeah, and I will admit, this is one case where after the fact, when once the reveal got made, this is not a show that I've tended to, dig around with to seeing internet comments and stuff, but discovered that yes, there were some people out there who had kind of tweaked on or twigged on what was going on with Elliot. I certainly I had been having my issues with Elliot as unreliable narrator and things not quite seeming right, even though this certainly wasn't necessarily quite as big a sort of ground shaking a twist as in the first season, but I thought especially stretching this out over 7 episodes, though the way they did, that final reveal of that Elliot, yes, and it is in fact in prison somehow, and we still don't know exactly why. I still think rather nicely done, and now we get to play the fun game of all this stuff that Elliot was showing us, what was actually going on, and how is this going to shake out? I am rather looking forward to.
Well, there were some people who felt like this was a huge jump the shark moment,
yes.
a phrase that everybody who has been listening for any amount of time knows I can't stand. But and one of the reasons is that, no, this was not something that just came out of the blue as a rating stunt.
No.
No, this actually makes sense of some things that weren't adding up,
yes.
which is kind of the way that it should be. And we also know that Elliot is a hugely unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
It would make sense that he would take a really horrifying personal situation and reform it in his own perception as something more, less threatening, slightly less. And it also makes perfect sense that he would feel trapped and therefore that his only option was for him to, quote unquote, make peace with Mr. Robot.
Mm-hmm.
So it does all add up. And in fact, it takes some of those early season issues that I was kind of struggling with in terms of trying to figure out how it fit together, and it put it into a context.
Mm-hmm.
Now it makes sense. Well, from Elliot's point of view, it makes sense. It would be scary if it totally made sense, but there we are. Let's see. So anything else that we want to say about this one? I mean, like I said, Angela and her power plays were pretty interesting here. They didn't quite pan out for her as much as she probably would have hoped that they would, but it was fun to see her actually taking some degree of agency back.
Yes.
After feeling like she was a bit underwater, let's put it that way.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, that means that we can move on to the episodes that were in the middle of the pack this week. And the first one on our list here is Killjoys, Season 2, Episode 8, Full Metal Monk. Clues from Klein's Red 17 transmission lead Dutch, Davin, and Alvis to an old research facility on Arkin. Meanwhile, Johnny and Polder try to rally outside support in the impending war for Westerly. And this one came in at an average of 8.67. So definitely getting some pretty top marks. And yeah, as far as I'm concerned, this show is running on all cylinders and loving the wardrobe department right now. Especially for Potter, just saying.
Oh my, I agree.
Yeah. But yeah, Gary, your thoughts on this, because you've been really giving Killjoy some pretty high scores lately.
Oh yeah, I think they're knocking it out of the park. If Klein had actually showed up in this episode, it might have even made it up to a 10. First off, could I have a Johnny and Potter spinoff, please?
Well,
what fun chemistry those two have with each other too. They play off each other so well. It's a joy to watch it, and darn funny on top of it. That was definitely my favorite part. Before we go any further with it, that being said. I enjoyed how they brought the monk that we had seen earlier back, sort of back full circle, and really involved him in this whole plot line. I never saw this twist coming, but they laid it out very well. So, bravo to the writers as they went down to Arkin and found this yet another hidden base of Klein's. We run across this monk and a whole bunch of equipment in there, and we have to wonder, was this the first place they were making level sixes? And it just, while it gave us some answers, it opened up so many more questions. It was just phenomenal. I enjoyed the sort of the revelation of what the wall around Old Town finally was meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
And how they sort of, while I'm not sure what the actual, why they decided to reveal it just now and then, but it seemed like it was ahead of schedule slightly, but I guess Potter was really going to blow the lid on everything, so they didn't have a choice to do so. But it was very interesting. While we expected it to honestly to be some sort of death ray or killing machine of some sort, it turned out to be in some ways quite the opposite, whether it was just the sort of this euphoric feeling, which was unexpected too. Another good twist in this episode. I'll say revelation, but it's almost more of like heartbreak that Johnny was working outside of the team with Potter the whole time. And, it ended up with him for, first being in that cage. And then, Dutch says, let her get you out. not really being as cold-hearted as it seemed once we figured out that, you know, Potter was rather easily able to get him out, much easier than Dutch would have been able to. So, you know, everything sort of, well, is definitely advancing forward in unexpected and cool new ways. We got to see more sixes killed, and, you know, we definitely see that it's much more of a problem than we ever suspected. We have this whole time gap thing with Klein where I don't know if they're trying to hint that he's been around now for hundreds of years, but it sure seems that way. And then now we have to, you know, wonder about, you know, Dutch and Anila. You know, if they look so much like each other, are we talking about brother, sister? I mean, sister and sister. Are we talking about clones or is she really Anila all along? Who knows? We'll have to, you know, wait and see. But this this really has me both hanging on the edge of my seat from this, you know, the slow revelation of all these mysteries to the, you know, the character moments, like when Dutch is talking to Johnny about this whole thing. And you just, you know, felt the, geez, I don't know if betrayal is the right word, but definitely like disappointed or let down. You know, it just, you know, really hit me really hard. And as you mentioned earlier, the scene where they're high, for lack of a better term, was just downright hilarious too. So, yes. You know, opening mystery, hilarious moments, good personal interaction, excellent episode. Did you guys like have, you know, a favorite point that you know, stood out for either one of you?
How about you, Edmund?
Well, I think for me, I mean, yeah, I mean, this revelation of the wall, rather than being a, you know, yes, a sort of an instrument of incarceration or separation, the way you traditionally think about it, that now this this idea that it's actually there to enclose all the communities and just create this nice, docile, easily manipulated workforce. I thought, given you know, sort of some of the corporate nature of the entities they're dealing with, was a very nice little twist but also the way that was just kind of folded in, I mean, in the background, you know, as the, you know, the sort of underlying basis of what was this very entertaining episode, and just indicative of, I mean, as you know, as we've been going on, I mean, with these two Friday shows, where, you know, Killjoys is doing a wonderful job of creating these characters who we have a lot of fun with and really enjoy and are starting to care about, in, you know, with, you know, set within this darker context of what's going on with the Ark and Klein and the nobility, as we will get to, where dark matter just isn't quite turning that corner for me.
Yeah, for me, I guess I just gotta say Johnny and Potter were hilarious in this episode. So that was probably my favorite part of the whole thing. I could watch those two all day. But yeah, I think you kind of put it well, Gary, that everything is coming together. Which, of course, with this season only being 10 episodes, yeah, there's only a couple more left, and things should be coming together. So I think they're doing a pretty bang up job of that. Any other thoughts on this one, Gary?
I like the effect. I like the part that while, you know, they're sort of that up at least until this moment, they were still trying to work the system until this episode, it all fell apart. You know, they're trying to pull warrants to cover themselves. And, you know, it seemed like they were trying to sneak around, even though, honestly, all the forces against them could care less. So it was interesting how they were trying to do everything at least reasonably the right way when everything else was starting to, you know, just blow up.
Yeah. It, definitely the show doing extremely well this season, so still pretty happy, especially with the fact that the show has been renewed. All right, next we have on the list Stranger Things, Season 1, Episode 6, The Monster. Jonathan goes in search for Nancy, while Steve does the same, and Hopper and Joyce unearth the truth behind the lab's experiments. This one came in at an 8.5. I really like the fact that we are just similar to Killjoys, a couple episodes from the end, and so we are getting some revelations, some pretty big ones. So, the truth about Eleven is coming to the forefront, and it's pretty interesting and creepy. So, some good storytelling going on here. I do recommend it. It's only 8 episodes, so it's worth seeing so far. Next on the list, we have The Last Ship, Season 3, Episode 10, Scuttle. Chandler faces a tough decision when the White House delivers a bizarre order. And this one came in at an average of 8.33. And Gary, you gave this one an 8.5, and you seem to have been liking this episode and the season so far quite a bit.
Yes, I did. And actually, here they did manage to salvage a plot line for me, at least, the whole St. Louis federal government. It was really starting to get stale, and even with the impending... what's the word I'm looking for? Coup d'etat. It still wasn't generating much interest with me, but with, geez, and I'll forget her name, but our former, Nathan James, a sailor now that's now on the run as a result of all the machinations that have been happening. It's really sort of put a really nice anxiety level into me, and I'm very anxious both for her and to see how this plot line's going to develop. And so that's really cool, the fact that they realized that there is somebody on the inside, even with the Nathan James, was interesting. Not only that, but this whole I don't know if I want to call it a mutiny per se, but I guess you technically could, because mm-hmm. another captain had taken charge of the Nathan James. That was very interesting how it was done. I enjoyed the court-martial hoops that were being jumped through to occupy the opposing senior staff while everyone else went to retake the ship. And it made sense too, you know, as they talk about, you know, the captain, you know, going by his gut, and he's had to in the past. It made a certain sense. But then you also understood the other captain having just lost his ship, over a third of his crew, that he'd be emotionally, compromised, and he would want to seek the familiar and the regular flow of orders and such. So that made sense too. And they brought that sort of whole government conspiracy tension back around very well for me, and I'm looking forward to see how it resolves and how people from the Nathan James are going to manage to make it back to St. Louis. It should be quite interesting, but I would hope that it. Geez, I don't want St. Louis to become the sole focus of the show either, but it seems inevitable from what I'm seeing right now. I hope it does it though.
How about you, Edmund?
I was also enjoying. I mean, you know, even though to some extent, I mean, certainly the whole concept of orders coming through from the commander in chief that may or may not be legitimate is a bit of a cliche. But I thought they did handle it rather well. Even though, given that on this show, certainly, I mean, you know, this is a sort of a political thriller angle that could be played for ambiguity. But on the last ship, and we always know who the good guys and bad guys are. So you know, yeah, there was a certain inevitability to them taking the ship back. I still felt that they played it rather well, even given that sort of standard nature of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, this episode, I think, despite the fact that you could pretty much see where it was going from the very beginning, I still think that it played up its themes pretty well. And this is also another example of where I felt like, you know, we've made the inevitable comparisons previously to Crusade and where that was supposed to go, and this just mm-hmm. feels like another episode that could have easily fit that mold. In fact, I think that it's pretty blatant that it would have fit in that mold. But.
Yeah. I was thinking that and thinking, oh, gosh, boy, that would that have been great. Anyway, go
ahead. No, I mean, that's really it, is that, you know, this – I think we mentioned last time that the whole current conspiracy angle really has salvaged the season much as and perhaps to an even greater extent than the plot twist on Mr. Robot helped to elevate that season even more.
Mm-hmm.
But Edmund, you were going to say something.
It was just occurring to me that, you know, yes, I can see where Eric Dane and Gary Cole do seem to have a sort of similar command style. So
yeah, it's not too far off. All right, let's see. Next on the list, we have finally Dark Matter, Season 2, Episode 8: Stuff to Steal, People to Kill. Sadly, there is no recap for this one, but it did come in an average of 7.83, which, again, it's towards the bottom of the list, but the last few episodes have actually had an average that has been pretty good for this show. So, yeah, this would be their version, I guess, of the Mirror Universe, Gary?
Yeah, that's about as best as I could put it. I appreciate the homage, of course, but I just had a hard time hooking myself into this one. I enjoy the characters in the normal universe, so I thought it would be fun, but I didn't care about these people. I guess is sort of what it came down to. I never really liked them that much. Not even enough to hate them.
Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole problem with doing a mirror universe episode when you haven't done a good job of really establishing the main characters and their personalities, which is what I know I've been, I think most of us have been complaining about with this show. Thinking in terms of where this production staff came from. I mean, this is Jay Firestone and some of the other folks from Lost Girl. This is the other thing I do find intriguing about this Friday night lineup is that you basically got the creator of Lost Girl and the people who were producing Lost Girl putting on these two shows back to back. With Dark Matter, it's just still this issue of if you're going into your second season and you're doing a Mirror Universe episode, this should work really well if you've established the characters, and they just still haven't. Showing the mirror versions of themselves when you don't have a good handle on who the Prime Universe people are, and there's, it's even still up in the air about they had their memories wiped, and the Mirror Universe folks is perhaps the more like they originally were, but I'm still not hooked into the story into their backstories enough to necessarily care all that much.
Yeah, I was actually feeling pretty much the same way. Just the fact that it's hard for me to care about a Mirror Universe for characters where I don't have a good grasp of who they are. If I know them really well, like, say, the characters from Star Trek, then it makes sense. And you'll notice that in most cases, they waited until late enough in the game for those mirror versions to actually be distinctly different.
Yeah.
Here, I feel like they kind of were for a couple characters, but in other cases, if I still don't really have a good handle on the motivations of the characters to begin with...
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to, or why am I going to care about, the differences? It's some good plot items or plot twists in there, machinations, whatever you want to call them, but just really hard for me to get my self to care too much about just the circumstances and that the characters were finding themselves in. I don't know.
Yeah,
I know, Gary, that they seem to speak to you a little bit more than they speak to Edmund and I.
I know. That's
been the case for a while.
Yeah, and that's why I just, like I said, it fell flat. I was even hoping, okay, maybe there's going to be some reverse reveal about some of the, conspiracies going on. Maybe we'll see something, to give us a clue. Nope. So, or at least nothing I picked up on. So I was just generally disappointing, and I'm usually much stronger on this show, so I was sad to see it. I mean, it wasn't a horrible episode, but I really couldn't call it good.
Yeah, and also, I mean, just to go back to the Lost Girl analogies, I seem to remember it was, I think it was in Lost Girl's second season, and about this point when they did their, it's not a mirror universe, but they did their body swap episode, and pulled it off brilliantly, precisely because there was such a strong sense of the characters, and they built up such a good camaraderie, obviously, among the cast and crew, to where it was obvious that everyone was having a great time imitating it, imitating all their good buddies, I was not getting it anywhere close to that that sort of sense with this episode.
Yeah, I guess they were trying to, in some ways, be pretty clever and subtle about some things. But again, the problem is that Mirror Universe episodes never were successful because they were subtle and clever.
Yeah.
they play broadly. That's what the whole idea is. I mean, it granted, that's because that's the way that the first one played.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
but it was,
Well, the thing that cracks me up is that the moment you said that, what immediately flashed in my head was Sulu coming onto Uhura in the original Star Trek episode.
Or, you know, Spock.
Yeah.
So distinctly evil because, you know, he's got a goatee.
Yes, of course.
It's a universal sign, John.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. So that's it for this week. But we have to say, though, Dark Matter did not end up in the bottom of the list.
No.
At the bottom of the list. So that's at least something, right? All right, a little bit shorter show this time, but we are kind of in that pre-Dragon Con phase. So next time we are going to get into our or finish up with our annual top 10 shows from the 2015-2016 season. And we'll also give a little bit of a rundown in terms of where we'll be, if you're going to be at Dragon Con, where we'll be and when, for at least our fan panel contributions and so forth. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.